This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, rumors have been swirling in San Luis Obispo about that MindBody acquisition. The company's CEO recently stopped in to give details of the deal.
You don't pay $1.9 billion for a company to tear it apart. That doesn't make any sense.
And later, it's not too early to start thinking about the next big election. California's Secretary of State speaks with us about some changes coming to California's next presidential primary.
By moving us up in the schedule, California is extremely relevant. We're going to be voting the first Tuesday of March.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, February 25th, 2018. I'm Tyler Pratt.
The $1.9 billion deal that put San Luis Obispo's MindBody in the hands of a San Francisco company has been finalized. The health and wellness company has filed its final documents with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and is now under the ownership of Vista Equity Partners. Joining me now is the man that's had to stay tight-lipped on the deal until it went through, MindBody CEO Rick Stohlmeyer. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Tyler.
Okay, Rick, welcome back. You've been on before. Fantastic interview on the KCBX website.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Tell me about this deal. How did it happen?
Well, first of all, super excited about this being done. This is a great, momentous occasion for MindBody, for our team members, for our customers. For me as the co-founder and 19-year CEO of the company, I couldn't be more pumped about where we're going to go from here. And so how this happened is that, you know, as a public company, our stock has been very volatile. It's gone way up and way down. And, you know, you don't worry too much about that. You can't as a public company. But we were definitely getting some serious choppy waters in the back half of 18. And so as we started to get some of those choppy waters, we had multiple people reach out to us to say, hey, look, we could take you out of those choppy waters and put you into a safer harbor where you could strengthen this company and achieve more. That's basically their pitch. And so the kinds of people that would buy what we are really a mid-cap public company are either what's called financial acquirers, they're private equity firms, literally pools of money that go out and invest in businesses and then help improve those businesses and then eventually sell them. Or it could be a large strategic acquirer, which might be some large household name brand. And our board of directors looked at this and said, you know what, we should at least hear what they have to say. And so throughout November and December, we met with dozens of different potential acquirers. And all has to be done in complete secrecy. In fact, almost no one at MindBody knew. And because you don't want to freak people out because, you know, people are going to go to a place of fear. Like, this means something terrible is about to happen. It doesn't. You don't pay $1.9 billion for a company to tear it apart. That doesn't make any sense. While there have been private equity firms in the past that would buy companies for the purpose of sort of splitting them apart, you know, and that is not what most of them do today, and that's certainly not what Vista Equity Partners does. Vista Equity Partners has an unparalleled track record of buying very good to great companies and making them even greater and making them grow faster and achieve more. And that's what's going to happen with MindBody. I just spent all day with our executive team spent the entire day with our counterparts at Vista on our campus and started talking about what our plans are. And I'm pumped. In fact, I'm kind of like thrilled, happy, and a little exhausted because it was a huge conversation. And so opens up a new chapter. And it's really good.
Well, I'm going to jump ahead a bit then. What are some of the plans?
So the plans, first and foremost, are to step on the gas. We're going to, as a public company, a software business like this, software as a service, you typically are investing capital in advance of getting returns. The idea is you build out new capabilities, you spend the money to enter new markets, you spend the money with all the sales and marketing people to bring these customers on board, and then hopefully you have long-term relationships with these businesses that you're serving with your software. In our case, thousands, tens of thousands of typically small fitness studios, salons, and spas. We have about 65,000 of them around the world right now. So you're constrained by how much can you invest to grow that, to build a better product, to enter new markets. And so as a public company, we were under severe pressure to be profitable. And while that may seem illogical, like why would a business exist without being profitable? Yes, long term, we're going to be a very profitable business. But in the near term, we saw opportunities to invest more. So what Vista enables us to do is to invest more. And that means more jobs. That means better product. That means more software and services for our customers. So we're enabling our customers to succeed. And it hopefully means, and we certainly believe it'll mean, much greater Mindbody 2, 3, 4 years from now.
So your shareholders were overwhelmingly in favor of the deal.
Yes, they were.
Tens of millions in favor, but there were also millions against. What did you hear from some of those not on board?
Well, the only reason to be against the deal is if someone felt we didn't get a good enough price for the deal. It's like, imagine a group of people own a piece of real estate together, and the majority decide to sell that piece of real estate for a price, and the minority are compelled to participate in that sale, and they say, "Now wait a minute, you know, this piece of property was worth more than that." So that's really was their claim. And by the way, every single one of these acquisitions typically has lawsuits. So it really was expected and typically not that big a deal. We have one very large shareholder who was quite noisy about their lawsuits. And it's sort of a backwards compliment because what they're saying is, hey, you guys are a lot more valuable than $1.9 billion. And frankly, as the founder, I'm flattered. But obviously, the board of directors and I don't agree. I mean, I'm on the board, and unanimously, we voted for this deal, and overwhelmingly, our shareholders supported it. And it's kind of like a midterm election. It's a matter of like who votes. And actually, we had a lot more people voting than we expected, and far more people voted for than against.
So that $1.9 billion price tag,
yeah.
How will it be dispersed in the company? Can employees expect any raises anytime soon?
So, no, this is the ownership changing hands. So that has no direct impact on our employees. In fact, most of our employees will see no change whatsoever. Over the long term, over the course of the next few years, you know, we're going to see certain teams growing faster. Our product development team and technology team is going to grow faster. Our sales and marketing team is going to grow faster. But as far as people's comp and benefits, it's, you know, it's business as usual. And so where does the money go? The money goes to the owners of the company, which, by the way, a large number of those owners are, in fact, employees. And so many of them now have what's called liquidity. They now have cash for their ownership, and they no longer have an ownership position in the business.
What will your new role in the company be?
I'm still the CEO of the company. And actually, one small change. I was the chairman and CEO. I was actually the chairman of the board. Now I'm the CEO. We have a chairman, Robert Smith, who is the founder and chairman of Vista Equity Partners. Really impressive leader. Robert Smith is a guy, I really encourage everyone to take a look at him. There's a great, if you go on YouTube and search for Robert Smith, Vista, Bloomberg interview, there is an on-camera interview of him that really captures his essence. African-American, raised by two school teachers in Denver, trained as an engineer, got his degree as a chemical engineer, and then went into investment banking and realized in the 90s that the most exciting thing going on in our lifetime is software. The software was going to change the world, and grouped together with a couple of colleagues and formed Vista Equity Partners, ironically, at around exactly the same time that Blake Beltram and I were starting Mindbody. And so I really connect to Robert. He's an exceptional guy, definitely a self-made person. You know, that when you meet the Vista team, these aren't people with the pedigrees, you know, that went to Ivy League schools or Stanford. These are people that a lot of them are immigrants. A lot of them were raised without any money at all. They kind of had to work hard to get to where they were in their lives. The guy who actually led the deal for them is a guy named Monty Soroya, and he's a Cal Poly graduate. So his perspective on San Luis Obispo is, you know, he knows the town, knows who we are, or knows our community, and is excited about keeping Mindbody here.
You will be the only person left from Mindbody on your board, correct?
That's right. The biggest change is the board of directors, and these were all outside directors. You know, public companies, typically the directors are experienced executives or retired executives from different walks of life. And we had a magnificent board of directors, and that's probably The only thing about this transaction that I'm sad about is that I won't be continuing the professional relationship with this amazing seven outside directors. We're actually all going to meet for dinner together in San Francisco next week as a farewell, and it's a sad moment for me because they have poured their heart and soul into helping this business get to the next level, and including one of our earliest investors, Eric Liao, from IVP, which is a Sand Hill Road venture capital firm that believed in us before, you know, most anybody else did.
How are you feeling about jumping in with a whole new team, with a whole new board?
Well, I got to tell you, I'm pretty excited. So one of those board directors was here yesterday, his name is Nicholas Stahl, and just great. It's the first time our executives were able to connect to the Vista team members, and Nicholas, a senior member of Vista, and it's amazing. This is a very smart, switched on. They've done their homework. They ask really good questions. It's a dialogue. It's not a matter of them coming in and telling us unilaterally what we have to do. Vista's success has come about through accumulating over the course of nearly 20 years a set of best practices on how to help software companies succeed. And the basic insight is that most of us who built successful software companies had either a specialty in knowing how to code software, or we had an insight into a product market fit. And I'm in that second category where I understood the marketplace and had some insights into it, along with my co-founders. But nobody taught us how to run a big company. And that's one of the oddest parts of my life today is I'm a garage startup guy and I have 2,000 employees. And it's pretty lonely, you know, like your board of directors can advise you. You can hire consultants to help you. You can go out and hire talented people with experiences from other large companies. But at the end of the day, most of the decisions the CEO has to make on their own. And you try to make the best decisions you can, and it's quite challenging. And, you know, my batting average hasn't been 1,000. I mean, I've made some good decisions. I've made some not so good decisions. And the idea of Avista Equity Partners is they're going to help us improve our batting average.
For anyone just tuning in, I'm speaking with Rick Stolmeyer of Mindbody, talking about its recent close to $2 billion acquisition with Vista Equity Partners in San Francisco. For those that don't know, Mindbody is a big player here on the Central Coast. How many employees do you have, Rick?
So worldwide, we're just cresting 2,000 employees worldwide. In San Luis Obispo, we have about 950. We have another 100 approximately in Santa Maria.
And just remind everybody what it is that Mindbody does.
Oh, we're a software platform for the fitness, beauty, and wellness industry. So our customers are the small local businesses that we all go to, the salons, spas, fitness studios, health clubs. It sounds rather niche and small. It's actually a pretty giant market. There's over 300,000 of these businesses just in the 8 English-speaking countries that we focus on: U.S., Canada, U.K., Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, and Hong Kong. And today we have roughly 65,000 of those. So we have an enormous market to go after. And when we've gotten the majority of that market, there's a whole other global market to go after. And actually, we have customers in over 90 countries.
And what does this deal mean moving forward?
What this deal means is that we're going to be able to invest more in the development of our product. You know, I realized early on, even in the garage, the product was never going to be done. Once you've delivered a software product to someone who's using it to accomplish things, think about the software you use in your daily life. The first reaction you have is, wow, it's amazing. The software does what I need. Oh my gosh, there's like 12 other things I wish it did, or I wish it did better. And so we literally have a fire hose of requests from our customers to do more things with the software to help them run their businesses more effectively. That's what we do. We help these small business owners in the fitness and beauty and wellness space just run more effectively. For the vast majority of them, we frankly help them get control of their businesses to simplify their operations, to control their costs, and to bring in new customers. And most of our customers desperately need that. And my wife runs a spa, East Wellbeing and Tea, on Monterey Street. And she's a customer of Mindbody. Be awkward if she weren't. And every day she faces the challenges of how does she get enough new clients in the door to keep her massage therapist busy. My nephew Derek runs Rev Slow Fitness Studio over off of Broad Street. And same thing, I've watched him for 9 years doing that hard work. And that's been really instructive for me because I'm basically a customer of MindBody twice over because I'm partners in both of those businesses, of course. And there's so much more we can do for them. So number one, we're going to be able to serve our customers better. Number two, go get more customers, grow the business more.
Well, cool stuff. This is exciting for the company. So the big question on everyone's mind,
yeah,
is MindBody going to stay in San Luis Obispo?
Absolutely. 100% positive. You can bet on it. We're not leaving San Luis Obispo. Our new owners, Vista Equity Partners, love San Luis Obispo. They're very impressed with the community. They understand that we have a community that is both a great place to live and an amazing talent pool. The proximity to Cal Poly, the relationship we have with Cal Poly is a huge advantage. And I'd like to say to those locally, yeah, it doesn't feel like it, but actually relative to other really nice places to live where there's decent jobs, it's actually not that expensive.
And I got to ask, do you anticipate any layoffs?
No layoffs. No. I mean, I think that first and foremost, we're a performance-driven organization. So nobody that comes to work at MindBody is guaranteed their job. You know, we try to set people up for success and put them in the right roles. And we want to retain people as long as possible. And many of our team members have been with the company for more than a decade. In fact, of the six people that were in my garage, when we moved out of the garage in 2003, three of them are still with the company. And I think that's pretty amazing. So no, absolutely not laying off. Quite the opposite. We'll be recruiting even more. The bulk of the growth will be probably in our satellite offices. We have over 14 offices around the world, and we expect a lot of growth in places like Scottsdale, Atlanta. We have a small office in Sacramento in San Francisco that's going to grow a bit. We have an office in San Diego. We have offices in the UK and Sydney, Australia. So if you're interested in MindBody, as a local, just check our job site. There's always jobs posted up there. You know, naturally, when you have 900 and plus employees in a one town, there's people that are moving and life changing. And so there's typically roles opening up, new roles, you know, every month.
Well, Rick, tell me what this acquisition can mean for the Central Coast and its burgeoning tech industry.
I think it's a really positive sign for the Central Coast because just to have a business that was locally grown and nurtured in this community, a business that was built largely by Central Coast residents, a lot of Cal Poly grads, a lot of Gauchos, UC Santa Barbara grads, to have that business be able to go public. And we went public for about $550 million value. And then 4 years later, be bought for $1.9 billion. I think it speaks to the talent and capabilities of our community. And you see it happening. You see a burgeoning startup community building in San Luis Obispo. You see companies like Amazon deciding to build their staff. I mean, how many people are aware that Amazon is an employer in San Luis Obispo, an employer of well-compensated, very talented engineers. And think about what that contributes to our community for all the restaurants and coffee shops and bars and the schools. All of this provides a tax base for the Central Coast where we can have this beautiful lifestyle and have a good economy, a strong economy. So I'm really, to use Wall Street speak, I don't have to do that much anymore, I'm really bullish about the future of San Luis Obispo.
And what does this mean for the future of health and wellness tech?
I think that health and wellness is one of the largest and most important opportunities of our age. It's the reason that I've devoted almost 20 years of my life to this. It's the reason I'm not done yet. This got under my skin a long time ago, and Blake Belcher and I basically stumbled into our life's work. We think that technology in this space, and maybe I can come back on a later time and talk about where technology is going, is going to help people lead healthier, happier lives. I think the cost of doing that will come down for people. Right now, mainly affluent people are taking really good care of themselves. They're going to these spin classes and they're availing themselves of spa and wellness services. We've got to get that into the middle-income folks and lower-income folks as well. It's one of MindBody's big causes, and it's why we've partnered with Michelle Obama and the Partnership for Healthy America to bring that to a broader audience.
Is there anything you want to add now that you can speak about this acquisition?
Just that I just want to invite people to understand that when you hear news like this, the most important thing to do is wait till you hear the real information. I think a lot of rumors went around. A lot of people went to a fearful place. perhaps some local media said some things that frankly were just unkind, in particular suggesting that this was about some kind of payout for MindBody executives. That is not what this was about. Yes, I just sold a large part of my ownership in the company that I built across 20 years. That's not a payout to me. That's the thing that I risked my entire net worth and my career to build. And I'm incredibly fortunate and I feel very lucky. But I would like to ask people to put that into perspective.
Well, Rick, thanks so much for stopping by today. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Tyler.
Rick Stolmeyer, CEO for MindBody, San Luis Obispo's largest tech and wellness company, recently purchased for $1.9 billion by San Francisco company Vista Equity Partners. If you want to hear more about Rick and his company, his love of the Central Coast, the future of health and wellness tech, check out his interview from last year on the KCBX website. You're tuned to KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. Next, we speak to California's Secretary of State about a big change coming to California's elections in 2020. Here's KCBX's Greta Mart with part one of a two-part interview.
So I'm here in the KCBX studio with, may I ask you to introduce yourself?
Sure. This is Alex Padilla, California Secretary of State.
Tell me what's going to be different next year.
Well, starting in 2020, there's a couple of things that voters should keep in mind. Unless you've been living under a rock, you know that it's a presidential election year. And I'm very hopeful about not just increasing registration and new record registration numbers, but probably record turnout as well. Registration is now just shy of 20 million in California, and many more being registered each and every week through the DMV. So that's going to be a lot of voters on the rolls and in contention for all candidates for president. So new item number one for 2020 is an earlier primary. Californians are used to voting in June for the primary and then, of course, the November election. This will be the first year where we have a primary in March, making California much more relevant and important in the nomination process for candidates of all parties. So I'm excited about seeing candidates for president come to California and actually campaign, not just come here to raise money, but come here to earn Californians' support. So California voters, get ready when those candidates come through the neighborhood to ask your questions. What matters to you as you're deciding who to vote for? And while we're at it, in that primary, some important rules that are not new, but voters need to keep in mind. We've quickly gotten accustomed to this top two primary system. Anybody can vote for anybody, regardless of political party, and the top two candidates go on to the general election. That's the case for Congress. That's the case for state Senate. That's the case for state assembly and all the constitutional offices, but not in the presidential primary. The national political parties establish rules of who has an open primary, who has a closed primary. The last presidential election, only Republicans could vote for Republican candidates for president, for example. Democratic voters can vote amongst Democratic candidates, of course, but no party preference voters had the option of either keeping their nonpartisan ballot or requesting a crossover ballot and voting in the Democratic primary. So political parties at the national level decide who's an open primary, who's a closed primary, and voters need to make sure they're clear on what their options are.
Okay, so break that down a little bit for me. So what do I have to do if I want to, let's say, this is purely hypothetical, but I heard that Bernie Sanders is going to run. What if normally I'm a registered Republican and now I want to vote for Bernie? So what? Break it down exactly. What do I need to do?
Right. So I guess let me try to simplify it. As a voter in California, for most other races, you can vote for any candidate of your choice in the primary and the top two advance to the general election. When it comes to the presidential contest, your party affiliation can dictate which candidates are options for you in the primary. So Republican voters can vote amongst the Republican candidates for president in the primary, Democrats amongst the Democratic candidates for president, etc., so on down the line. No party preference voters. Their default ballot will be a nonpartisan ballot. If they want to choose amongst the Democratic candidates, they have to request a Democratic ballot. That's known as crossover voting. So it's important that voters know what they need to do when they go to the polls to either vote a nonpartisan ballot or a crossover voting, but they have to request the ballot of the party they want to vote in if that party allows for crossover voting.
Okay. And so remind us, like, why can't I just have a ballot that has everybody on it? Why does it have to be this way?
So again, in California, we have that as the case for all races from state constitutional officers to Congress to legislative seats, et cetera. But given the national laws and national roles of political parties, the political parties dictate the rules around presidential contests. And that's why the rules are just a little bit different only for presidential primaries.
Now I think I got it. All right. And tell me, why did this happen? Why is this move to March happening? Where did it start and how did it get there?
So I'm excited about the levels of energy and participation that I know we're going to see in next year's primary. Frankly, we made the choice to move the California primary from June to March. Historically, Californians have gone to the polls in a presidential primary when the nominees have pretty much been determined, meaning California votes in a primary were, at least from a presidential campaign standpoint, largely irrelevant. By moving us up in the schedule, California is extremely relevant. We're going to be voting the first Tuesday of March. If you vote by mail, you'll get your ballot in probably the first week of February of 2020. And so that's going to force candidates for president to actually have to come campaign here and earn the votes, earn the support of California voters, not just come here to raise money.
Got it. All right. And was it an act by the legislature? How did it get moved?
Yes. So in 2017, I sponsored legislation to make the shift to a March primary, not just one time. This is the new time frame for primaries for every presidential election going forward and the gubernatorial elections as well. So change that calendar permanently at home. March primary, November general, every election.
Well, you authored the legislation or you sponsored it?
I sponsored the legislation. I was no longer in the legislature at the time, so we worked closely with the legislature and the governor to do so. Just to add on to the benefit, I think, of California being much more relevant in the nomination process, and that's good for advocating for California issues regardless of who ends up in the White House. When California has gone early before, it increases turnout, so that's always good for democracy, increases the number of people voting in the primary, not just in that contest for president, but in all the down ballot races as well. So heaven forbid more voters chiming in on who their next member of Congress should be or who their legislators are, depending on the city that you live in. If your local elections align, maybe who your supervisor is, who the mayor is, who the school board member is, more people participating in elections is a very good thing.
All right. So you sponsored the legislation. It got passed. The governor signed it. When did it get signed into law? Was it 2017?
It was signed into law end of 2017. So this will be the first presidential contest where it's been in effect.
Okay. Got it. All right. And let's back up. How did it all work out? You became Secretary of State.
You know, about 6 years ago or so, when I saw that there was going to be an opening in the Secretary of State's office, not only did I study what that would mean for the state of California, but frankly, I had an eye on what was happening across the country. You know, if you look at states like Texas and North Carolina and Wisconsin and Alabama and others, you hear a lot more things like voter ID, purging of voter rolls, elimination of early voting opportunities, you know, frankly, policies that are making it harder for eligible citizens to register to vote or to actually cast their ballot, right? How un-American is that? You know, I was raised with the belief that our democracy works best when as many people participate as possible. So we should be looking at, yes, maintaining the integrity and the security of our elections, but facilitating people participating, making it easier for people to register and cast their ballot. So I ran for Secretary of State to do exactly that. You know, so we've championed policies like automatic voter registration in California. We champion policies like the Voters' Choice Act, which is giving voters more options of when, where, and how to cast a ballot. We've moved up the presidential primary to make us more relevant and engaged in the presidential contests. And lo and behold, 2016 happened. So add to the workload things like protecting our elections from foreign interference and how do we address disinformation that we see not just on, but especially on social media platforms.
That was California's Secretary of State Alex Padilla speaking with KCBX's Greta Mart. In the second half of this interview, Padilla talks about Census 2020 and how significant cuts by the Trump administration will impact how Californians are counted. Or not. Stay tuned for part two in March. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we're going to talk about Eating Disorder Awareness Week with a student who's battled eating disorders firsthand and the conversations with her dietitian that helped her get back on track.
I would just argue with her and say, this is the way that I think about that. And she'd say, no, I'm going to refute that with science. And that was really helpful to me, I think, to kind of start processing what could be wrong about the way I was thinking.
That's coming up on Issues and Ideas on KCBX. KCBX Spring Pledge Drive is almost here, and you could win a pair of tickets to the Live Oak Music Festival and a two-night stay at the all-new Kenny Slow Hotel. For your chance to win, make a pledge to KCBX by March 28th. Visit kcbx.org for all the details. Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. Eating Disorders Awareness Week is February 25th through March 3rd. Today, we're going to hear the story of Hannah Allen, a Cal Poly senior who recently shared her story with the San Luis Obispo Tribune in an effort to inform as many students as possible about an often hidden illness that could affect around 1,200 Cal Poly students. Joining Hannah is the author of the Tribune story, Monica Vaughn, and Libby Parker, an eating disorder registered dietitian. Hannah kicked off the conversation.
So I'm from the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, Sunnyvale, California, and I came to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo mainly for the running team and for the biology major. The science department here was amazing, and my parents and I were super jazzed about it. My main reason for coming here really was the team. I was recruited as a walk-on with potential to be on the traveling team for that incoming fall quarter. And kind of throughout my first and second year, I was doing pretty well with school and everything. It was a good experience. I loved the school. I loved my teammates. And I really wanted to do anything that I could to get on the traveling team, as I'm sure a lot of freshmen that year did. And things kind of declined a little bit for me when I was focused on losing weight. And for that fall quarter, it was really tough because I wanted to do anything I could to be on the traveling competitive team that was going to compete that year. So when I quit in spring of my freshman year, that was when the eating disorder really started.
Well, how did this eating disorder present itself in your life at this time in college?
Yeah, so my freshman year was mainly, it was losing weight. So I kind of started off more anorexic because one of the coaches had suggested that to get faster, I could lose weight. And at that time, it was a lot of weight that she had asked me. She had said, oh, yeah, this is healthy. You could get to this point. And I kind of took that as a motivation. Oh, well, if I lose 20, 25 pounds, that'll get me to my goal weight. And if I'm lighter, I'm faster for running, right? So it made sense in my head. And I started cutting back more on what I ate. And people started telling me, wow, you look so good. You look skinny. You look really lean. I'm liking this. And then I was running faster because I was in my head. I was like, oh, well, I have less fat on my legs, so I'm running faster. It's great. So it definitely was more anorexic in the beginning. And once I quit the team, I had quit more because of parent pressure from school. You know, they were a little concerned that my grades were dropping because I wasn't putting as much time or energy into other things. I was really focused only on my running, and they thought that was super unhealthy, which it was. I didn't realize it at the time, but quitting was a huge deal for me because those were my group of friends, my only group of friends really, and it was really hard to leave and all of a sudden just have a bunch of extra time where I wasn't running. And, you know, even if I was, I compared myself all the time to what other girls were eating. And that's when it became more bulimic and the purging kind of started.
Oh, wow. I want to just go back for a second. You had a coach tell you to lose 20 to 25 pounds?
She said I could get there in a healthy way. We were looking at the BMI chart. You know, I just asked her. I was like, what can I do to get on the traveling team? I want to get faster. And, you know, she had recommended starting to watch my diet. And we had a lot of meetings about diet and losing weight. And I kind of thought in my head that it was a doable goal just because I really trusted her, you know, and I think it's also that point where, you know, I was an impressionable freshman. I think a lot of girls are, and they just want to do anything they can to be the fastest. And, you know, I didn't really it was a BMI chart, so it seemed pretty scientific.
Libby, this feels like a great time to go ahead and jump in here. Is this a story that you hear from incoming freshmen?
Oh, yeah. And not specific to the athletes. I mean, I see probably more runners than anything else, like if you had to, you know, put them into categories. But freshmen in general, or, you know, transitions into college, the transition from high school into college is just such a big time for students to develop eating disorders. Or if they had one previously, it's a good time for it to come up again. Because when we're under stress and transition and scared, even though it's an exciting time for most people, that requires a coping mechanism to come back up. So whether they're actually trying to lose weight or they're just really stressed out, this eating disorders are a coping mechanism. So they're leaning on that in that time of transition.
Where does your role fall into all of this for students coming in and possibly struggling with this?
As a registered dietitian, my job is really around the dietary component of it. So I look at all the, you know, tons of research out there on food and diets and how it, you know, works in the human body. And my, you know, the main job of a dietitian is kind of disseminating that information for the masses, because everyone has an opinion on what to eat. I mean, we hear every day people talking on the internet like, oh, I did this diet and I lost 20 pounds and I did this. And, you know, like, and there's not a lot of scientific evidence behind a lot of these things. And like even BMI that you're mentioning there, and Hannah was mentioning, it's not a really great indicator of health. Those benchmarks that the BMI is, which is body mass index, which is weight for height, was something that was developed a long time ago in young, healthy white males. It's not, you know, the end-all be-all for all populations. Like if you're a different race, if you're female, it doesn't necessarily correlate really well. And it doesn't tell us anything about body composition, such as, you know, muscle mass versus fat mass and things like that.
Hannah, did you think that you could reach out to a dietitian at any of this point? Did you reach out to anybody? Did you feel like those resources were there?
You know, I didn't think to do that at all. I didn't think it was a problem with what that coach was telling me, and because she was the coach and I trusted her and she had been my main kind of go-to for the recruiting process. And I loved her, I respected her, and, you know, I had a good relationship with her. So I didn't really think that there was a need to reach out to a dietitian and talk about it, because we were already spending a lot of time doing that, yeah.
And then things quickly started spiraling for you?
Yeah. I would say that that was when things really started going downhill, kind of after that fall quarter. And it, we talk about eating disorders as very dynamic things. They're not normally one condition and only that condition. They can also fluctuate from, you know, so in my case, it was I exhibited more anorexic behaviors, and then it kind of transitioned into bulimia. And a lot of other people kind of go through binging cycles, you know. So there's a lot that went on, and I would say that was just the start of it.
How long would you say that this the worst of it lasted for?
I would say the worst of it lasted I would say for 3 months. 3 months I was purging pretty often every day, and it was, you know, after most meals.
Were there any medical complications?
Absolutely. There were. I started developing acid reflux, and I thought at first, because my dad had that, it was, oh, it wasn't an issue. This is normal part of my family's congenital history. Maybe it's not that big of an issue. That didn't really call attention to it. But I would get pretty uncomfortable after every meal and feel like my throat was constricting. I had there was a time during my fall quarter of my sophomore year that my mouth was starting to get really sore, and I couldn't keep food down.
This might be a great time to turn back to you, Libby, that eating disorders like anorexia and bulimia take a real toll on the body.
Absolutely. We see whether you're in the denial phase or not, which a lot of people start in because they think they're starting a healthy lifestyle or something, which is usually the precursor to an eating disorder. Medical complications can really develop without showing a lot of outward signs. So Hannah's acid reflux, obviously she felt that. A lot of people aren't realizing what the damage they're actually doing to their organs and their body on the inside, because if they were to get blood work done, their labs are going to look perfect until it's really late in the game. So it's very hard to detect, especially if someone is still at a normal body weight, which most eating disorders are not the emaciated, anorexic-looking person that we stereotype them as. Most people with eating disorders walking around are in a perfectly normal-sized body or maybe even in a larger body. So it's really hard to detect if someone is not proactively saying, I need help.
So it sounds like your parents stepped in.
My dad noticed that something was off. We had a moment after my sister's birthday where he actually saw me purge a little bit in the sink. And he stepped in and said, hey, this isn't normal. That doesn't look like acid reflux. This is something else. And you're not telling us everything. And I said, no, I've been telling you everything. This is normal for me to get pain after I eat, Dad. And he and my mom flipped out. So as I would expect them to, I guess. It was only a week or two before I went back to school. So they were pretty scared at that point, and they made me go into the Cal Poly Counseling Center. And they had me schedule an appointment with the therapist. They watched me schedule it, so they knew that I wasn't going to lie. And I saw a therapist there. And then the Cal Poly Counseling Center had also recommended I see a dietitian, and that person happened to be Libby. So,
and tell me a little bit about this portion of your journey, about coming to terms with all this and talking to experts.
I was still pretty much in denial about it. I'm sure as a lot of people are, because I was only going to therapy because my parents made me go. They said they would pull me out of school if I didn't go. So that
this
was kind
actually
of
actually really common. A lot of people go because my parents made me.
Yeah. So they don't, you know, I didn't really think that I had a problem. I knew that they were telling me I had abnormal eating behaviors, but it didn't click in my brain that it was something bad for me because I was still running really well. I was on the distance club. You know, I had just joined a competitive running team again, and I was still running fast, so it was great for me. So I think talking to Libby, she explains the science of it to you, and okay, this is what you do to your body when you don't feed it enough carbohydrates or lipids or glucose. And I remember arguing with her. I would just argue with her and say, you know, this is the way that I think about this, or this is a lie I believe about Ed. And she'd say, no, I'm going to refute that with science. And that was really helpful to me, I think, to kind of start processing what could be wrong about the way I was thinking regarding the eating disorder. It was I wouldn't say I really made progress until about a year later. I didn't actually come to terms with, okay, I need help, until about a year later.
And you touched on something. You named your eating disorder.
I did name it. Yes, it's actually a pretty common thing, I think, in therapy for eating disorders to name it. And the most common name for it is Ed. And it kind of helps to personify the eating disorder in my experience. For me, it allowed me to better separate me from my eating disorder. It allowed me to feel more liberated from it. If I think of it as a separate entity, it's not who I am. It's just something that I'm struggling with. And at that point,
I think the thing to remember with eating disorders, and it took until I really learned this part of the science behind it to be okay with people being in denial for a while, is that when people have not been fueling their body properly, usually under eating or not getting the right mix of nutrients, so some sort of malnourishment, the brain actually starts to shrink and causes cognitive distortions. So they're not thinking clearly when they're in this malnourished state, and that makes it very hard for them to think they have a problem. The longer they are malnourished, so the people who are very deep in like anorexia nervosa, they are going to be fighting this tooth and nail because they don't think they have a problem. They can logic their way into anything. So it's really slowing down, stepping back, showing them the science, coming alongside them, and explaining that you may feel okay right now, but if you keep doing what you're doing, this is the long-term consequences of it.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. In case you're just joining us, I'm Tyler Pratt, and I'm speaking with Hannah Allen, a Cal Poly senior who developed bulimia as a student athlete her freshman year. This week is Eating Disorders Awareness Week. Hannah is joined by her dietitian, Libby Parker, and Monica Vaughn, who has penned Hannah's story in the San Luis Obispo Tribune. Monica takes the lead on this portion of our conversation.
What I found striking as after I first spoke with Hannah, she's unique in that she understands scientifically how the eating disorder is affecting her physiologically and psychologically, but she's not unique in that she struggled in this problem in secret and in shame. I found that there's a Healthy Mind study out of the University of Michigan that does random surveys for mental health issues on 60 college campuses around the country. And last year, they found that 10% of students surveyed showed signs of likely struggling with an eating disorder. That's 10% of likely 10% of college students. And Cal Poly, the first time they participated in that survey in 2016, had 6% of students likely suffering with an eating disorder. And based on the college campus population, that's 1,200 students, and it's likely higher than 6%. It's probably between 6 and 10%. And on Cal Poly, you know, it is a campus that's really focused on athleticism, on fitness, and on health. And I'm really surprised and shocked in the when I started investigating the issue at how little we're talking about eating disorders as a serious illness and that needs to be addressed. Cal Poly doesn't track how many students seek help for eating disorders, let alone how many might have them or have been found to have had them. And even within our community-wide, we know that, you know, anybody in the population can be affected by an eating disorder. The most common is binge eating disorder, but there's also anorexia and bulimia. And that ranges from children all the way to, you know, 90-year-old adults and more. And I was really surprised as I was working on this story, I happened to get the San Luis Obispo County. They recently released a 75-page county health assessment. And it did discuss healthy eating within the context of obesity, but there was nothing in the entire document that described eating disorders or talked about them as a community issue.
That's really surprising considering the efforts that this county goes to work towards mental health.
Right.
You think that would be covered in there. Have you spoke with anybody at the county to talk about increasing that awareness or plans moving forward?
I haven't talked with anybody at the county. I have talked with Cal Poly spokespeople, and apparently, you know, as I learned from Hannah, it sounds, and from Libby, it sounds like athletes have a really high risk of eating disorders. A well-respected study found that in a study of Division I NCAA athletes, over a third of female athletes reported attitudes and symptoms, placing them at high risk for anorexia. And the same thing is true. It's not that high, but it also exists for male athletes, particularly in running and wrestling. So I'm really interested to know how college campuses, what I'm looking at now is how college campuses are addressing student athlete education, as well as screening for potential eating disorders. And Matt Lazier at Cal Poly did tell me that the sports medicine staff is in the process right now of implementing a mental health questionnaire for all the teams, and that includes a component on disordered eating. And I believe that sports medicine staff talks with them about eating and disordered eating as an aspect of overall health, maybe at the beginning of the year. You know, I'm interested to see if this comes to fruition and if there is an increase of student education, because right now, you know, just from what I've learned from talking to Hannah and from Libby about other students is there's not a lot of awareness.
Yeah, I want to follow up on that with a little more statistics as well. So my master's thesis was on prevalence and prevention of eating disorders among college females. And there's not a lot of data out there on males, which is why it wasn't a little more comprehensive than that. But the studies were showing from Healthy Minds and some other studies that beyond the diagnosable eating disorder statistics that Monica was talking about of the 6 and 10%, about 50% of college females will exhibit disordered eating. So that means that they're not clinically diagnosable, but they are, it's something that definitely could turn into a full-blown eating disorder, and it's definitely affecting their quality of life and probably their health. So it doesn't have to be this like super intense clinical diagnosis, need to be in a treatment center, eating disorder to impact your life negatively.
So this is Eating Disorder Awareness Week. This runs February 25th through the 3rd. And I'm glad that you mentioned bringing light to more about eating disorders. I think people mostly think of anorexia and bulimia, but
yes,
there's a whole other spectrum of eating disorders, and it also affects men as well.
Yes. And we're also seeing, higher prevalence rates in the LGBTQ plus community. So anytime, again, that we're using it as a coping mechanism, it's a really big thing. And males are less likely to seek help because it's stereotypical that it's a girl's disease or something. So, most males are not talking about their feelings a lot. And eating disorders can look very different. There's something coined bigorexia, which is, the trying to put on more muscle mass and be bigger. And it's, or called reverse anorexia. There's a lot of different, eating disorders that fit under a different heading, like chewing and spitting out food, diabetics who manipulate their insulin to try to manipulate their weight. There is a whole host of behaviors that are not normal and are not good for the body or the mind.
I just want to talk about why awareness seems to be so important for a moment. It is a really hidden and secretive problem. And just as anecdotal evidence, we found that when Hannah spoke out about her story and her experience, she had, friends and other people that came to her and said that I'm experiencing this too, and she was able to direct them to help. In addition to that, this was maybe one of the most impactful phone calls that I've ever gotten about a story that I've published, but I had an elderly man who lives in the county who is 82 years old and called me and told me that he's been struggling with binge eating his entire life, and he finally wanted to get help after reading the story. And I directed him to Libby, and that was just amazing to me. And I think it's an example of when people start to hear it being talked about and explained what it is, that does lead to improved health outcomes.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Hannah, talk to us about your journey coming forward and your life since the story's been published. And you've probably been talking to a lot of people about this. How
yes.
are you feeling?
I've been shocked at the amount of positive feedback that's come out of this story, and even just positivity in general about people that have read it or have gone through it. For some reason, I was thinking that people would have more of a negative opinion, that they would think I was disgusting for sharing it, or I shouldn't have shared that much because it was too personal. And I really think it's been amazing since the story's come out, honestly. I know a couple of my friends, that have come up to me after the story, after reading it. They've said, hey, can I grab coffee with you? And then told me about the fact that they're starting to go to therapy for the first time, which is amazing. And I see them kind of starting to address something that they kind of thought was maybe there before but didn't actually address for a while. And I see them getting help, which is so amazing. And a lot of my professors have come up to me and said, hey, I'm really proud of you for doing this. And, I read your article in the Tribune, and, I think it's really brave that you came forward. I've had other people say, wow, you're cured. That's great. And, I was just like, well, that I wouldn't say cured. I think eating disorders and recovery in general for mental health is an ongoing process, right? But I think overall, the positivity from it has been really, really cool to see. And it kind of, as I've talked about it more, it's gotten easier to talk about it and kind of start conversations about it, which is so important. People just need to know that what they're feeling is normal. Those are completely normal thoughts to have, especially when you're going through really big transition periods in your life, like coming to college, and also especially in the athletic community, to be focused on your weight and wanting to get faster. It's really important for people to know that they're not alone, and I hope that's what the story helped accomplish.
We also talked about feeling worthy earlier. Do you feel worthy now, or are you getting there?
I definitely feel way more worthy than I felt in the middle of this eating disorder, or really even half a year ago, you know, when this, you know, we were starting to think about what this article would look like. And I would say even telling the story to Monica for the first time in kind of a setting that I knew would be more public, that was really, really difficult. And I was ashamed. I had emailed her a couple times saying, I don't know if I want to share that. And she had encouraged me and said, no, I really think people will relate to it more if you're real about your struggle. And I think you sharing these personal experiences really will allow people to connect more with, you know, what they're struggling with what you're struggling with. And I think it just helps lessen the stigma around mental health in general, anxiety and depression and eating disorders. There's so many students, especially in Cal Poly, but more so people in the SLO County that struggle with mental health. And a lot of the time it's easy to get into a cycle of thinking where you're feeling like, wow, I'm the weird one. No one else is struggling with this because it hasn't been talked about. And that's just not the truth at all. I think everybody experiences thoughts like that, and they need to know that.
Before we go today, I just wanted to open up the floor to everybody. What more can colleges do to assist with eating disorders?
There's actually a lot colleges can be doing. And just from the little research I've done, there's not a lot of colleges that are doing a whole lot about eating disorders in general, not in a great sense other than having, you know, general counselors on campus. None of the three colleges in our area are really super focused on eating disorders, and none of them currently have a dietitian on campus working with their health center. That's an integral part of the treatment team for eating disorders. I mean, we've already shown that statistics among colleges are very high for eating disorder population, and really colleges should be having trained professionals in this area, you know, whether it's a therapist, a dietitian, a medical provider. Typically, they're not getting a lot of eating disorder education just straight out of school. If you want to specialize in this field, you need to go above and beyond doing continuing education, finding mentors, really getting that experience. So getting specialists on-site on the schools is really what needs to be done, because this is a huge population. So yeah, we need to have trained professionals on site. We need to have communication amongst the professionals. So being able to have the doctor and the therapist talking to each other, that's something that is just not done in a lot of college settings, which is so weird. And that's just something to do with the legalities of it. If you went to any treatment center, they would be talking all the time.
Well, Hannah, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us. Congratulations on your journey. And
thank you. Of course.
Good luck as you move forward. And Monica, we have more to look forward to from you. I'm sure you'll be keeping an eye on this from Cal Poly.
I will.
If anyone wants to read your story, it's up on the Tribune website. That's sanluisobispo.com.
That's right.
Monica Vaughn, Hannah Allen, and Libby Parker, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us today.
Thank you, Tyler.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to hear more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.